This report was brought to you by our good friends at River. Want to do mining? Talking about mining, River makes it very easy to mine in a professional way. You go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account. You go to river.com/mining after that, and you can pick an ASIC. They have many ASICs for sale. Some are already plugged in with hosting contracts, so you can buy an ASIC and lock in a hosting contract immediately. You purchase it. You're already up and hashing and sats are streaming to your River account, whether you're an individual or a larger institution that wants to mine a lot. River is here to help you. They have a white glove professional service that'll walk you through the process, that'll get you set up. Or if you don't want them to walk you through the process, you can just go through the website, through the app, and do it without having to talk to anybody. Which I shouldn't say, I'm not certain, but maybe you do have to talk to somebody. But point is, it's a great way to mine. You're doing it the right way. So go check it out. Go to river.com/TFTC. Set up an account today. ASICs are cheap. Still cheap. Still in the bear market. It's a good time. About 11 months out from the halving. So get all those sats with 6.25 block subsidy rewards while you can. river.com/TFTC. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends down the hall, Unchained. They're here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. They're building a Bitcoin financial institution the right way by leveraging Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their vault product is a 2 or 3 multi-sig wallet. It allows you to hold 2 keys and Unchained to hold 1. You eliminate single points of failure in this model. Since you hold 2 keys, you control the Bitcoin in the vault at any given point in time. But if you're ever in a pinch, Unchained is there to be the second in the 2 or 3 multi-sig quorum. Beyond that, they have their trading desk. If you want to buy Bitcoin and send it straight to your vault after you have it set up, Unchained's the best place to do it. You can do it all in one place. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin in bulk. You buy and it goes straight to cold storage. On top of that, they have their lending desk, their IRA, their inheritance protocol, again, all revolving around native multi-sig properties that Bitcoin has that reduces single points of failure. It is the future. Go to unchained.com. Tell them the TFTC sent you. Talk to their concierge team. They'll walk you through everything I just described. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is here to help you bring sovereignty back to your healthcare and how you pay for it. Incumbent health insurance is notoriously opaque, expensive, impersonal. CrowdHealth is the complete opposite. It's cheaper. It's transparent. And it's very personal. You get a personal health advocate once you get onboarded to CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. So the way it works is you become a member. And then when you have to go to the doctor, you let CrowdHealth know, hey, I'm going to go to the doctor. They'll either help you find one or connect to your doctor that you're going to. Once you go to the doctor, you get the bill. You bring it back to CrowdHealth. They negotiate the bill lower with the doctor. And then you pay the first $500 of that bill. And the rest gets crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth community. Me and my family are on this. We've used this. It works flawlessly. And again, it's cheaper because you have metrics that you have to meet to get into the CrowdHealth community. It's a relatively healthier community of individuals. And so overall healthcare costs for the CrowdHealth community are lower. So you're paying less than you would with insurance. So if you're on COBRA, any of that stuff, consider CrowdHealth. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Sign up today. And get a deal on your membership fees for the first 6 months. This report was also brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. It's a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. If you're a company in the space looking to hire the best talent in the world, go get set up with Bitcoin Talent Co. They'll understand your needs, what you are looking for, what your company does. Again, it's a recruiting firm by Bitcoiners, so they understand the difference between multi-sig, mining, lightning. They actually understand Bitcoin, so you're not just spraying and praying with a random recruiter to hope that they can actually understand what you need. Bitcoin Talent Co. will understand, already does understand. Likewise, if you are talent stranded in big tech, big banking, big finance, you're a Bitcoiner looking to get into the space, set up a profile with Bitcoin Talent Co. Go to bitcointalent.co to do all this. Tell them the TFTC sent you and enjoy this rip.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free. If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to TFTC. It's Marty Bent here sitting down with John Titus from Best Evidence. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Marty. First time here.
Well, very excited. You came from a very strong recommendation, which was Whitney Webb, and I have caught some of your Best Evidence videos in the past, but a couple weeks ago I went back and watched the last four, and I think the content you're putting out is very important, particularly now in the context of this banking crisis and the Fed's reaction to that and everything that's going on. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions, maybe not misconceptions, but maybe people are over-indexing on what you would define as the solvency problem that the banks have and really disregarding the liquidity problem that the banks have. So I think to start off this conversation, it's really diving to that concept of solvency versus liquidity and what people are missing.
Yeah. You want to talk about that?
Yes, please.
It's so you could call it solvency versus liquidity. To me, what people are overlooking is, let's just start with, you're ignoring a huge elephant in the room. Let's just call it a whale. And the elephant that people are ignoring is during the Senate hearings on the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, it comes out that bank had 10 deposit accounts with $13 billion sitting in them that left the bank and essentially gutted the bank. Then another, a total of $42 billion leaves in six hours. And that's what killed that bank. And now there's sort of some revisionism going on, to my mind, where people are like, well, the bank was really dumb. The officers are just really stupid. They lent out a bunch of money at a low interest rate, and now that interest rates are higher, those loans aren't worth as much. And that's where it's like, well, no. That's not the problem. The problem is money leaving the bank all at once. Let's just get back to that. That is a liquidity problem. Your liquid is being drained out of your body at a rate that your body can't sustain, and the body dies. So Silicon Valley Bank is dead. First Republic, Signature Bank, all have massive liquidity problems with those massive deposits left the bank. So all these people trying to cast this as a solvency issue, a solvency issue meaning your assets aren't worth as much as your liabilities. But now that could be true for a long time. I mean, banks can exist in a state of insolvency for years because that's really just a spreadsheet problem. And I talk about that in the video, the Killer Whales video, where you could have, who cares if your spreadsheet is showing assets worth less than liabilities? As long as nobody really comes to the bank and says, hey, I need my money out now, it's not a problem. But when they do, and people come into the bank and say, you know what, I've got $1 billion on account with you, and I want to cash out, or I want to transfer that money, now it's a liquidity problem. And the liquidity problem is what killed these banks. Yeah, solvency was a problem. And in fact, I did a video on it called Why is the Fed Provoking a Financial Crisis? In which I said, there's a banking crisis going on right now. And I said that video came out February 15th. That's 3 weeks and 2 days before Silicon Valley Bank failed. I anticipated that crisis. I could see it coming a mile away. Not on the basis of a solvency problem, although I certainly identified that. To me, the tip off was, it's not just a solvency problem, it's a liquidity problem too. And the tip off for me was that the banks, as of February 15th, 2023, were borrowing heavily and rapidly and suddenly from the Federal Home Loan Board banks. They were panic borrowing, I call it. And that is always, if you look at graphs, historical graphs, you'll see that every time there's a banking crisis, there's always a spike in borrowing and panic borrowing from the Federal Home Loan Board banks. And that's what tipped me off. Even though I said, yeah, it is a solvency problem too, that's not really the defining feature of this crisis. And so that should answer your question about why it's a liquidity problem, people wanting their money out, not so much a solvency problem.
Yeah, and I think the most jarring stat that you pointed out in your killer whale video was the fact that pre-COVID, the average bank account by the largest account holders at some of these banks was around $496,000. And after all the money printing that went on post-COVID, that jumped up to around $5 million, which is pretty stunning.
Yeah, there's a lot of stats in... There's a lot of stats in that video. I mean, my presentation style is I go into the details of stuff, and I do present jarring details because I think that they have a better tendency to get remembered. But the stat that was the one you're talking about is the Federal Reserve and another agency. They track checkable deposits by household, by a wealth band. And if you look at the top wealth band, the top one they track is the top 0.1%. So the top one household in 1,000, and what they showed there is, and you see this in the video, the average household in the top 0.1%, right in the first quarter of 2020, so right before COVID started, they had $565,000 in of checkable deposits, and then in the first quarter of 2022, that amount had multiplied by 8 and was up at $5 million per household sitting in checkable deposits, you know. And I don't have to tell you that money is most of that money is uninsured. The FDIC insurance limit is $250,000. So sort of a backdrop question on the whole video is, why are these accounts being maintained for years with it basically wholly at risk?
Yeah. What do you think was driving the growth in those accounts? Was it purely money printing? Was it people taking money off the table from stocks and rolling it back into cash?
If they take money off, okay, so those are two different things, and those are good questions. But if someone sells, let's say that someone's got 1,000 shares of IBM stock and they sell it, that doesn't change the amount of money. It'll change the amount of money in household accounts, so that'll drive it up, but it won't drive up the checkable deposits system-wide, okay? What drove up deposits system wide was the Federal Reserve printed up $4.5 trillion of reserves, and they bought assets. Okay, which is what they did during the global financial crisis. The Fed did the same thing during the global financial crisis, but there's a very big difference between the global financial crisis and the pandemic that you need to know about if you are going to understand why deposits went up during the pandemic, but not during the global financial crisis. The global financial crisis, when the Fed printed up, let's say it was $1.5 trillion or $2 trillion of reserves, the Fed bought assets with those reserves, but they bought them from banks. And when the Fed buys assets from banks, it's a two-party transaction because the banks have accounts at the Fed. So if, let's say, the Bank of America sells a $1 billion mortgage-backed security to the Fed, the way that works is the Fed prints up $1 trillion in reserves. It credits Bank of America's account at the Fed. So now Bank of America has an extra $1 billion on deposit at the Fed. And at the same time, that mortgage-backed security now appears as an asset on the Fed's balance sheet. The liability is the new Bank of America deposit for $1 billion. But that's a two-party transaction. When, by contrast, and during the pandemic, the Fed takes that $1 trillion in reserves or $1 billion in reserves or whatever it is and buys an asset from a non-bank, non-banks don't have accounts at the Fed. So it has to be a three-party transaction, the third party being the non-bank's bank, which does have an account at the Fed. So the Fed uses banks with accounts at the Fed as intermediaries whenever it's buying assets from the non-banks. And when that happens, let's say the Fed printed up $1 trillion of reserves and bought assets. When it buys from non-banks, yeah, there's a new $1 trillion of reserves, but there's also and necessarily and inherently a new $1 trillion of bank deposits. And that's the difference with the pandemic. And that's why those checkable deposit graphs look like they do. They all look the same. They all look like this. They're kind of jumping along, and then the pandemic hits, and the graphs basically go vertical, and people's accounts get multiplied by anywhere from 2.56 times if you're in the lower 50 percentile of households and checkable deposits, that their accounts got multiplied by 2.56 before and after the pandemic, up to the top 0.1%, and their accounts got multiplied by 7.77. And each stratus up, the multiplier was higher. There was no, it was completely sequential. And that was really sort of the telltale sign that something, the hugest accounts, the hugest household deposit accounts of the Fed are really massive now. And that's what came out during that testimony of Silicon Valley Bank. It's like, you have, come again, you have 10 depositors with $13 billion. Who keeps that much money in their bank account? And why would you do, I could see maybe doing that for a day, you know, maybe a week at the outside. This is going on for 3 years. And that's what that video really gets into, is this is what is going on here. And the thing is, nobody's talking about this. Well, I am, but nobody else is, not that I know of.
Yeah, everybody seems to be focused on the solvency side, the duration mismatch and the selling off of those assets and the falling.
It's a patsy. That's a patsy. That's as big of a patsy as, oh, well, what caused the crisis? Well, people have apps and they're transferring billions of dollars out of their account on apps. That's a patsy too. They're not addressing the elephant in the room, is that why do people have billion-dollar accounts? Why are they being yanked all at once? And where did those accounts come from? And the answer, every single time you start asking questions about where things came from, why things happen, it's the Fed. If you ask, why do people pull the money out? The answer is, well, their interest rates are higher now. Who raised the interest rates? The Fed. Who created the billion-dollar accounts to begin with? The Fed. You know, all signs point to the Fed in this crisis, and no one's talking about that. During the testimony, even, you see these bank officers get up there, and the line of questioning is largely, well, aren't you a dumb, Mr. President? You had a duration mismatch and yada, yada, yada. And the bank presidents are just sitting there like, oh, well, yes, I guess I am. And not one of them said, hey, you know, when you bought $1 billion of assets from one of my customers, you didn't ask me about it. You simply used my bank as an instrumentality of your own policy. So, you know, you've got a big hand in this. And not one Fed, not one bank president, not one bank executive pointed to the Fed and said, well, that's the problem.
That gets into the question, why is that? Are they simply ignorant that the Fed has created this problem? And
usually when people do that is they've made an agreement. They've agreed to not throw their boss under the bus. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest. Those guys are let's just get right down to brass tacks. The banks that failed, okay, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic Bank, those are the richest banks in the country. If you look at the percentage of deposits at those banks that is north of $250,000, those banks rank 1, 2, and 3 among banks with $100 billion of assets. 1, 2, and 3. They are the richest banks in the country. Their executives are paid richly. And to get paid, I'm sorry, in this crony economy, to get paid the kind of money you're getting paid, when you see people dragging down $10, $20, $30, $40 million, they've agreed to do bad things. And one of the things I'm sure that the bank presidents agreed to do was keep their mouth shut about what went on with those asset purchases. Because not one of them mentioned, oh, by the way, the $1 billion that flew out of my bank, that was created by a Fed asset purchase from one customer. Nobody ever said that, and yet we know that's what happened. The Fed wrote I've been making videos for years saying when the Fed buys assets from non-banks, the Fed is creating bank deposits, okay, period, full stop. Anybody who doesn't agree with that simply does not know what they're talking about. And the Fed finally, after 3 or 4 videos, they came out and wrote a paper saying, yeah, when we buy assets from non-banks, which like we did during the pandemic, deposits get created. We are creating deposits. Fed asset purchases from non-banks create deposits. And nobody's mentioning that. And it's like, well, the deposit base during the pandemic went in the U.S. and went from $13.5 trillion to about $18 trillion in the space of a very short amount of time. And it's just like trending along linearly, and then boom, it goes to $18 trillion. That's all from the Federal Reserve. And no one mentions it. It's ridiculous. And now we have a crisis on their hands, and people are blaming this nonsense like apps and liquidity mismatches. Yeah, those things are contributing factors, but you're missing the 357 Magnum to the head of the banks that went off, and the smoke is coming out of the bank's head. you're ignoring that and you're concentrating on, well, what kind of suit was the guy wearing? You know, what street was he on when he got shot in the head? It's like, well, does anybody want to talk about the bullet in the head of the banks? That seems like a logical place to start, but no.
Yeah.
They try to keep it all esoteric and mysterious. It's ridiculous.
Well, it is very confusing. They successfully got everybody talking about duration mismatches and the ability to incite bank runs in the age of social media and mobile apps.
And they're trying to fish it as a regional bank crisis. Like, this is going on in Mayberry, North Carolina. Oh, yeah, the bank that went down, that's where Andy and Opie bank. Sheriff Andy banks there, and a bank went down. It just failed. It's like, no. These are some of the biggest banks in the country, and their depositors are being hoovered up by institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, it's not hard to connect the dots when you sit down and you look at the data instead of relying on yarns like liquidity mismatches and apps.
Yeah, well, that gets to the meat of the question. What is the intent? Is it simply incompetence, or is there an asserted effort to consolidate all these banks up into the J.P. Morgans of the world?
I think it's a concerted effort. I don't think it's accidental at all. I mean, the fact that the three banks had the highest concentration of wealthy depositors is no accident. The fact that the three banks that failed, there are 4,700 banks in the U.S. The three that failed are in the top 32. The odds of three random banks being in the top 47, okay, not the top 32, but in the top 47, are 1 in 100 times 1 in 100 times 1 in 100. It's less than 1 in a million. All right. That's not a random event. This is a deliberate event. It's like a game of Pac-Man. And the next rung down, the too big to fail banks aren't the ones that are failing, because they're protected, you know, by the Prince of Darkness on high. It's the layer below. I mean, seriously, they've been protected for a long time, right? I mean, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, those are the four big commercial banks going into the global financial crisis. And then along come Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. They get their commercial banking licenses overnight from the Fed. And it's like, well, if you paid back TARP and you pay back your bailout, how come Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs still have their commercial banking licenses? If the bailouts are over, give your licenses back and just go back to becoming an investment bank. So now you've got six too big to fail banks institutionally recognized as too big to fail, and they're swooping in, they're absorbing the failures from this next rung down.
And is this asserted effort the Fed trying to put the genie back in the bottle and have somewhat of a soft landing via consolidation, or do you think it's just go for total control?
I think those are two different things. Let me put it in a sentence. I think it's possible to achieve total control with a soft landing. You do it slowly. Mm-hmm. So you got 34 banks in the U.S. with $100 billion of assets and more. Six of them we already know about, I've already talked about. So that leaves roughly 28. Few of those are foreign, HSBC, UBS, and the like. You can throw those out too, because they're too big to fail too, even though their numbers within the U.S. jurisdiction don't put them in the biggest of the big. But they're above the law. They're not going to be touched. So they're safe too. I think that what you do, and what we're seeing is you move to a CBDC. To me, it looks like that next layer of banks is being sort of rolled up into the too big to fails, which are getting bigger. And that's why you're seeing this false pitch of this crisis as a regional banking crisis. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank, in terms of assets, it's got north of $200 billion in assets. The bank was bigger on a GDP basis than Greece. These are huge banks. It's not a regional bank. Okay, this is a whale bank. It's a massive, powerful bank with a lot of money in it. I mean, do you think your corner bank has 10 depositors who have $13 billion between them in their accounts? No, it doesn't. And these are big, powerful banks. And they're the ones, I think, that are getting absorbed as the Fed wants to move to central bank digital currency. And it realizes we live in a two-tier system, our monetary system, where you have the Fed as a top issuer. Technically, it's three tiers, but practically it's two tiers. At the top, you have the Fed issuing money. And then the next tier down is the commercial banks issuing credit issuing deposits. They create those out of thin air. The third tier is the Treasury issuing coins, but that's de minimis. But those are the two tiers. And what the Fed has to do to get the CBDC is it's got to radically change that middle tier of commercial banks, that second tier down. And one way to do that is just to consolidate the banking industry into, you know, four or six or whatever it is, big players, and then iron something out there. But right now, with 4,700 banks on their roster, it's unmanageable. That doesn't give them the control that they want.
Well, that's been the big knock on CBDCs, or the idea that they will become a thing. The biggest pushback is that the commercial banks will never let it happen because they get cut out of the equation. If you can just go directly from a Fed account to individual consumers, the JP Morgans, BOAs, Wells Fargos of the world won't accept that and won't allow that because they get cut out and they're not able to make their fees. But I think there's another theory that Whitney and I have actually talked about, is just you just consolidate up to the big four and they act as a UI, and they're able to say it's not technically a CBDC.
You consolidate up to the big four and you make a deal with the guys like Jamie Dimon.
Yeah. And it's, so how do we protect against this? Or, I mean, this is a Bitcoin podcast. That's why I focus on Bitcoin and like to talk with individuals like yourself, is because number one, I think this information needs to get out there. Number two, we need to talk about solutions.
You get on the phone with your representatives. You got to call your representatives, number one. Number two, stick with your local bank, you know, just through thick and thin, because those banks are actually the healthiest. If you look at the numbers, it's really the best banks are the ones that are smaller, so long as they're well run. You can find some dogs among small banks too, don't get me wrong, but the best run banks tend to be medium and small size banks. Stick with your local bank. The third thing to do, I'd recommend, is just transact in cash. Don't let them take cash away, because once you go all electronic, you got a problem on your hands. You remember there was a speech, was actually a symposium in October of 2020, where Jerome Powell was there, the chair of the Fed, and Augustin Carstens, who's the GM of the Bank for International Settlements, was there. And Carstens gets this insane look in his eye and says, well, the problem with a $100 bill and the problem with a 1,000 peso note is we don't know who has that money and we don't know what they're spending it on. And then he launches into why CBDC is great. He's like, well, CBDC is great because we have total control over how people spend that money, which tells you right there that they don't have control and they don't. And he says flat out, we don't know who has the cash and we don't know what they're spending it on. And that ought to be a huge green flag for what you ought to be transacting in. And that's just at a minimum to do those things.
Yeah. Now the CBDC world is untenable if you want to live in a world with freedom and liberty, and they seem dead set. Like it's weird. It feels like they're slow rolling the CBDC too. One day they'll be like, "Oh, these are a really good idea," and the next they'll be like, "Oh, maybe we can't do it." But
yeah, the pitches on CBDC. Let me talk about two different things about CBDC. I noticed one is that the storylines that they come out with, like the reason they need CBDCs, are just ludicrous. Okay, one of their pitches is, well, we want to help the unbanked. So, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, people, you know, they don't have bank accounts. It's like, really? You're worried about people who don't have enough money. They're living under a bridge. They're living in a forest. They don't have an account, and that's really your concern? It's the unbanked. You know, that's just nonsense. The other thing out there is that they're talking about, and pretty open about it, is there's lawyer articles and speeches and symposia. You can see where these so-called legal scholars and legal experts get up, and monetary experts, and they say, you know, well, the great thing about CBDC is if the Fed prints too much money, that we can rein inflation in simply by debiting people's accounts at the Fed. Isn't that great? And that was Biden nominated a professor of law from Cornell, Sala Omarova, to be head of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And she had written this whole law review article talk about, you know, CBDC and how great it was. And one of the things she says in the article is, yeah, you could debit, get too much inflation, don't worry about it. Just take money out of people's accounts. There's another guy, it was at a symposium in the IMF. He's a big IMF guy. I think he might be a GM or a deputy GM. He's up there in the third or even second tier of the IMF. His name is Bo Li. Bo, just B-O-L-I, Li. And this is a Harvard-educated attorney who says, yeah, well, the CBDC, you know, we can control, you know, we can control people's food with CBDC. And they're going to control what you eat. And he's all excited about it. It's like, these people, they're psychopaths. And they're open about it. They're open about it. They're forthright and freely discuss their plans for just controlling everybody else. And they're happy about it. It's unbelievable what goes on in broad daylight.
No, it's pretty disgusting. And in the one video that you mentioned, Bo Li, you mentioned that he had legal tender, the definition of legal tender. You try to say CBDCs will be acceptable because they will technically be legal tender. And you had a very good retort to that, that's actually not true. And
no, well, he doesn't know, number one, because there is no CBDC legislation in the U.S. yet. But what he said was in all countries, money issued by the central bank is legal tender. And electronic money issued by the bank is legal tender. It's like, no, money, you know, in the U.S., the only legal tender is cash and coins. And the Federal Reserve issues cash, but it's technically, it's printed by the Treasury. And the Federal Reserve doesn't issue coins at all. Coins are legal tender too. They're issued and printed, minted by the Treasury. So he's just way off on that. But what he's getting at, though, and what gets me is, if they're going to make CBDC legal tender, let me back up. What is legal tender? Legal tender is money, okay? All legal tender is money, but not all money is legal tender, okay? Legal tender is money that if you offer it to someone in payment of a debt you owe to that someone, that debt is discharged regardless of the fact of whether that someone accepts the money. So let's say you owe somebody $1,000 and the debt it's documented. You owe the electric company $1,000 and you offer to pay that company $1,000 in cash and they turn you down and then they come after you for payment. Your defense in that lawsuit is that debt is discharged and that power company is going to lose that lawsuit. Because you tendered legal tender and they turned it down. You know, that's the power of legal tender. So in other words, when you're a creditor, someone's offering you legal tender, you better accept it or you run the risk of not collecting at all. And that's where I think Bo Li and the gang at the IMF have fantasies of taking CBDC is if we make it legal tender, then we can crush out small and medium businesses by having a bunch of customers go in offering them CBDC, having them turn it down, and then having whatever assets on their books, you know, where they've got it on their books as an asset that Joe, Charlie, and Sam owe $300 between them, and the Joe, Charlie, and Sam offer CBDC, and the business refuses, that business is going to be out $300. You know, I'm a cynical guy, and I'm looking at how the IMF, these people are up to no good. Okay, I know the aroma of them well, these psychopaths who are running things. And I think that you can just, whatever the worst fantasy you can imagine about what they're going to do, you're probably pretty close to the truth. And I think that's where they're going to carry legal tender. They're going to weaponize it as a concept.
What sent you down this path originally to do all this deep research and surface this information that many aren't seeing?
The bailouts of 2008, 2009, when I realized that the rule of law in the country was out the window. And I realized that most lawyers, that, you know, I'm a practicing attorney. You know, I talked to them about it. They didn't really care. You know, they didn't really think about that stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, you don't understand. I mean, if the rule of law is gone, meaning you no longer have, let me back up on the rule of law. The best formulation of the rule of law was probably by John Adams in the Massachusetts Constitution, where he says, we want to be a nation of laws, not of men. And what he means by that, he's expressly referring or implicitly referring to King George III and said, you know, we've had enough of this nonsense where one person decides the outcome of our lives. What we want is a system that's stable and predictable. We want a system where the law is the supreme ruler not some criminal like King George III. And that's what he said. Our ideal is we want to be a nation of laws, not of men. Now flash forward to the bailouts of 2008. And it's like, well, you know, they're bailouts because everybody knew the rules in advance, right? And you get an outcome that the powers that be don't like. So what do? They just ignore the rules and they bail their buddies out. That's a system where the rules get bent, and they're getting bent by the people who benefit from the rule chains, and they're getting bent by the people who lost under that system. The big banks are the ones that made the bad bets. They got lost and they were getting bailed out. And that's really what sent me down this path. As far as doing the research and stuff, I had always, you know, I cut my teeth litigating patents at a boutique law firm that was really successful. And it was successful by pursuing the method that I try to pursue on my channel, which is you just follow the details, stay true to the information, stay accurate, use documents, use admissions, use video of the person you're going after against them, and prove your case through documents and through admissions and through video. That's how you prove up your case, and you prove it block by block. So I'm just taking old methods that I picked up through patent litigation in my particular firm, a boutique firm, which of course got absorbed into a global firm. And you know, I basically left that firm after the bailouts to do my own thing. But I did that. That's a method I picked up and just am using in my channel as I talk about things like the rule of law and what's going on in the monetary system, because it's really in the monetary system where you find the root of the violation of the rule of law. You know, like when I first got into this, for the first few years, I was like, well, why aren't the banks being prosecuted? And there was a documentary done by PBS Frontline called The Untouchables, in which Lanny Breuer, the deputy attorney general at the time, admitted that the banks weren't even investigated. It wasn't that they weren't prosecuted, which everybody knew. The Justice Department was not even investigating these banks. And to me, that was like, well, if you're not investigating the banks, that means you're above the law. But and that's a bad thing, don't get me wrong. But that's ultimately, I kind of came out to thinking that's really more an effect than a cause. When I went in, I was thinking that's the cause of the problem. And I was like, nah, not really. They didn't get that power overnight. They didn't get the power of being immune from criminal prosecution overnight. They acquired it somehow. They had some pre-existing power that I need to discover. Like what is the magic fairy dust they have? What's the source of it? And ultimately I came and found out, well, it's the power to create money out of thin air. So if you really look at it, society, in American society, really throughout the West, it divides into two classes of people. One tiny little class of people is the people who are allowed to create money out of thin air and lend it out to everybody else. And then the second class is everybody else. And that to me is the central affront to the rule of law, because you have in advance, you've tilted the playing field, you've skewed the playing field in favor of the people who are allowed to create money out of thin air and lend it out to everybody else at interest. That's our monetary system. And that's kind of where I am now. But that took a while to evolve to that. And you can sort of trace it through my videos. I don't do that many videos. I think I've done a total of 34 in 9 years. So I'm at a more casual production pace than most video channels. But that's basically the evolution of my channel and of my own thinking on monetary policy and monetary reality and the rule of law.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you. That's what we have outside the studio here is fix the money, fix the world. We think the core of all the issues today, whether it be the monetary issues, getting into the social and healthcare stuff, it all leaks into everything that has completely corrupted our society. And as you mentioned in a lot of your videos, you bring up the real AOC. There were people who could see this rot begin before the Federal Reserve even existed. Once you understand how the mechanics of the system work, it's pretty obvious that the rules aren't tilted. And it's really disheartening, disencouraging, I don't know how to put it, but like today's day and world, people just simply don't know how the Federal Reserve works. Most people think it's a federal agency. They still think the dollar's backed by gold.
Right.
And that's the massive problem. How do you get people to realize, like, all the problems that you're seeing throughout society, they stem because we fucked up the money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big problem. And there's a lot of like sub problems. I know a lot of people who they kind of know something's wrong with the Federal Reserve. They sort of sense that something is fundamentally off with having the Fed, but they benefit from the system. So as long as they themselves are benefiting and as long as they themselves remain in the top 1% or the top 0.1%, they're like, well, everything's hunky-dory. And some of them are even like, how dare you criticize the Fed? Warren Buffett says the Fed is great. Who are you to say otherwise? And say, well, you know, if you read monetary history, you understand that the Fed, it's not great. It's fundamentally, it's a problem because when you create money, they're not even really creating money. They're creating credit out of thin air, which they lend out at interest. And the problem with that is that interest payment, it goes back into the class of people that's creating the money. It goes into, let's just call it, some people call it the rentier class. I just call it the parasite class. You're hoovering off, you're skimming off the top of the money supply interest payments that are getting fed back into the parasites. And they're coming out of the pockets of the people who produce and who create and who are original thinkers and everything else. And you're feeding the class of people who just like, you know what? I just want to kick back and go get a check out of a mailbox that's your interest payment. And that can go on for a while, but eventually that system is going to implode on itself. That's really where our system is now. China and Russia have the same. They also have a debt-based monetary system over there, but they're early on. They're early on in the, you know, in the product curve. You know, we're up here on the top of the S. They're down here at the bottom of the S. So their problems are way down the road, but they're ultimately going to have the same problem too. But we're in an advanced state of decay right now. And what you're seeing now, a lot of the tumult you're seeing is people trying to come to grips with the fact that, yeah, we're going to have trouble making the interest payment, you know, on our debt. It's gotten so big because we just hoovered off too much interest over the years, really over the centuries. It's gotten to that.
Yeah. So you would agree we're probably in the end game of the dollar reserve system, the fiat system we've erected over here.
It's tricky. It's tricky. And the reason it's tricky is that the people, you know what a poison pill is? It's kind of like a poison. Can't, you do something where if your opponent strikes you back, they're gonna go down with you. You know, it's sort of like the scorpion and the frog. And the poison pill is 60% of the global monetary system, 60% of what we call money in the world is denominated in US dollars. And all those dollars are created as debt. So yeah, the dollar's in trouble, but there's a lot of dollars out there and a lot of people have a lot of those dollars. Now, I think what you're seeing, so they're not gonna shoot themselves in the head and flush the dollar down the toilet, right? They're just not gonna do that. But what you're seeing, I think, worldwide is you're seeing a lot of resources. Remember the dollar, once you go off the gold standard in 1971, you know, what do? Well, we went to the petrodollar. You required the oil producers to transact in US dollars. And they agreed to that. So it was a way to sort of maintain control and maintain the dominance of the dollar through resources. And you're sort of seeing among the BRICS right now, the same kind of jockeying of like, well, we're going to trade resources in our own currency. I think it's just a matter of time before they try to parlay their own new dominance with resources into a monetary dominance. But it's not, I don't see it being, I don't see the dollar house of cards. It's not going to end up like a game in Jenga. I think a lot of people are waiting for that Jenga peg or whatever to come out and the whole structure to fall down. I don't see that happening. I see it's a slower process. It's got to be because there's so much money in the world that's in it. It's expressed itself electronically, and it can vanish just as quickly as it was created, which is instantaneously.
Yeah. part of me hopes that it is a slow burn, just for the sake of the world not getting into a state of chaos, Mad Max scenario. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin? Again, that's, we've both, I think, come to the conclusion that money is the core. I, as an individual, decided I think Bitcoin can sort of get us back to a sane world. When you mention John Adams,
I don't understand it. I mean, I understand the, let me back up. I understand the impulse for it. I understand wanting to get away from the system where certain chosen few get to mint the money or create the credit out of thin air and lend it to the rest of us at interest. I get that. But I just, I'm fundamentally a suspicious person. I smelled a rat. Let me put it this way. I didn't really wake up to what was going on in the world until 2008 with the bailouts. And then I was like, whoa. I mean, I started to wake up and see what was going on. But I was, let's just say, I was pretty well dead asleep in front of the TV up until 2007, 2008, okay? And yet, even then, I remember in 2005 or so, whenever Facebook became the rage, I smelled a rat a mile away. I'm like, something's off here. And I never signed up for Facebook. And it's the same thing with anytime something new comes along and Bitcoin falls in that category, I was like, something's off with that. Like the white paper written by Satoshi Nakamoto. Like, who is that guy? What's his first name? What's his real name? Where does he live? Where did that guy go to college? Where does that dude buy his groceries? I don't know. He's a fictitious character. I'm a suspicious guy. So I've held off on, I've never owned, I don't want to say I've never owned a cryptocurrency or a digital kind of currency, because I do have a little bit of Monero that I got from someone in a wallet that is physical, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I have to put it in a USB port on my computer, but I don't do that because I'm suspicious. So I'm a Luddite, and I don't, I've just avoided all this stuff. It's like, well, what's wrong with cash? What the hell? Why don't we go back to that? So I don't, the short answer on Bitcoin is I don't know.
Yeah. Fair. Fair breakdown of why you're a bit suspicious. I mean, Satoshi, the argument for him being pseudo-anonymous is that he understood the gravity of what he was unleashing to the world and did not want to be identifiable, have the feds take him down, number one, and number two, just so there was no leader, there was no King George that could be identified and looked to.
There was no what?
For answers. There could be no King George in the Bitcoin sort of project, the open source coding project. And then when you mentioned John Adams, I want a nation of rules, not rulers. I think that's really what Bitcoin embodies at its heart. But I'm not here to hard sell you on
Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I understand the ledger system. I mean, I get that it's a transparent, system, and there's rules, and no one's got control over it. I kind of get the impulse for it. But the Satoshi to me is a red flag. The anonymity of him is a red flag. Yeah. I don't care whether it comes with the story or not. The story is as red as the initial flag was to me. But that's just one person's opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a lot of people I know made a lot of money on it. I know a guy got in, at under a buck, so he's a happy guy.
Yeah.
Happy for him. He's good.
That's a completely fair assessment. I'm not personally, obviously, as you can tell, got a whole podcast here about Bitcoin. Haven't been turned off by the pseudo anonymous nature of Satoshi, but yeah, I think that's why I'm drawn to it too, because I think I do view the banking, financial, political crisis, because it's multifaceted. It stems from the money, but it's created a political and cultural crisis. To me, it's like the only tangible, actionable thing to work against that, other than calling your representative or going to your local bank. But I really don't have much faith in the incumbent political or banking apparatuses.
Yeah. And that's a big problem too, is at the federal level. I say in that video, in the Fed killer whale video, that Congress is 100.0% corrupt. I don't think there's a straight member in there anymore. And which is that's bad news, because the constitutional, monetary authority that comes, it's in the Constitution. It's in Article 1. power to coin money and regulate the value of thereof. It's in Article 1 of Congress. So that, you know, money in the U.S., it's a creature of law. It's in your foundational document. There's no getting around that unless you want to jettison the Constitution. And that, to me, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, I got a lot of respect for the people who wrote it. I got a lot more respect from them than I do, you know, people today, by and large. So I think, to me, that's a radical notion. But I understand the impulse of, what do you do? And I've said this for a while. What do you do when your system, like ours, is that some people can commit crimes with total impunity, meaning the too big to fail banks can. I lay that out. I've made that case again and again and again. And ultimately, it comes down to your problem once you reach that stage of you've got a system that's where people are above the law. It's like, well, you no longer have a constitution. You no longer have a republic. You no longer have the rule of law. Because if someone can declare themselves above the law and they are above the law, that does fundamental violence to the notion of any kind of legal authority, of any kind of constitutional governance. And what it means ultimately is to correct that, your only remedy is a revolution. Because otherwise, anything short of a revolution means, in essence, what you're proposing is that the criminals who took over the system now take a vote and decide whether or not they get to stay in power.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to shake out? They're not going to take that vote. It's ridiculous to think that.
If you just vote harder, you can make the changes, you know?
Right. So I understand, you know, Bitcoin to me is that's the first, it's a stab in the right direction, because it's like, well, you do need a revolution of some kind. I just have let me put it this way. If someone could write a paragraph or a paper explaining why Bitcoin is the revolution that I'm looking for, I'm all eyes, I'm all ears. But I've never seen it. I've never seen anybody make out that case.
Hmm. Have people been hard selling you for years on it? Or?
No, people are just like, oh, well, you just don't understand Bitcoin. And I was like, yeah, I don't, you know. Sell me on it in a paragraph, you know, on why I bite into that as the way out of the mess we're in. But you got to understand the mess we're in. We're in a serious mess. We're in a bad way. Our system is run by criminals. You get that? Run by criminals. They'll kill you.
Yeah. And they're lying. And that's the other thing. They're very good at gaslighting and propaganda. They'll put out all this economic data and jobs numbers and CPI to make it look like things aren't as bad as they really are. But if you know inflation rate, and the one chart that jarred me last week, I tweeted this out, was the life expectancy in the U.S. It's collapsing right now. It's dropped from like 76 to 73.5, or other nations.
Whoa. I knew it was going down. I didn't realize it was that big.
Yeah. It's pretty big, and that's with the fentanyl crisis.
That's late stage. That's we're in the late stages. You know, once your monetary system goes, to me that's what's going on, and they've got to cope with that, because what's killing the financial system, what's killing the monetary system, is healthcare. You know, you can't have. I used to have a boss. I worked at a pizza place about 8 years. The guy who owned it was like. He's a Greek guy. He spoke in like fables, but he would say you can't have a million elk living in a field. It's like, that's the U.S. We've got a million. We've got too many old people drawing too much money from the health system. That's just not going to last that long. And unfortunately, what I see coming is not. They got to bring that down. The powers that be are going to do whatever they can to maintain control over this U.S. debt-based monetary system. They're going to do whatever they can to maintain that control. And if that means you got to off a bunch of old people, sick old people, then yeah, they'll do it. No doubt about that in my mind. I'm under no illusion whatsoever about that. So to hear that life expectancy in the U.S. is collapsing, not surprising at all to me. I mean, the amount is surprising simply because 3 year decline. That's a massive drop in basically a short amount of time. And it means there's a lot of dead people that I just didn't know about. That's the surprising part.
Yeah,
man, that's a lot of dead bodies, man.
It's like, it's actually, I was off by about a year. It's like 79 to 76 is the drop.
79.1 to 76.1.
I'm going off a rough chart with no hard data. I'll show you. It's right here. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a big drop, man. That's 79 to 73 years.
Yeah.
Over what period of time is that drop?
That's from like 2020 to today, or 2019 to today.
Oh, that is bad news bears. I'm gonna have to check that out. That's breathtaking.
Yeah. How do you stay optimistic in times like this? Can you stay optimistic, or are you an eternal pessimist?
You know, you gotta win the spiritual war, and you can't give in to fear. You know, Tom Paine said, you know, the only way that tyranny remains effective, the strength and power of tyranny, is it lies solely in the fear of resistance. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful statement. Another, so you can't be afraid. You got to swing. Yeah. You got to go down. You got to rise. You got to adopt the mindset of I'd rather go down swinging and die that way than die on my knees, not going out that way.
Agreed. And that's, I actually wrote about a Thomas Paine quote, in my newsletter a few weeks ago, essentially like, let the hard times come in my time, not my children's time. Is.
Yep.
That's what I think. We just got to rip the band-aid off and take it right now.
You got to take it. Yeah. It's like the Cypress Hill song. I remember the rap, the hip hop group from the early 90s. You know, I ain't going out like that. Nah.
Yeah.
Nah, I'm not going out like that. I'll take one for the team. I'll go down swinging, but I'm not going down on my knees.
No. Yeah. For my children's sake, they will not. I'd like to leave them a better world. So yeah. That's why.
I mean, at the end of the day, you maintain a good attitude by saying, you know what? It's like the movie Friday Night Lights, you know, where the coach, Billy Bob Thornton, says, you know, you have to be able to look yourself in the mirror and look yourself in the eye of the mirror and say, there's not a single solitary thing I could have done to make the different outcome. And then once you do that, your clarity of mind you'll get is amazing, because everything else becomes secondary. You don't have to worry about it. You know, just worry about yourself. And about what you can do, and don't worry about the whole wide world.
Yeah. Yeah. Actionable steps you can take. Take control of your money. Make sure your family's fed. You got water, all that stuff, all the essentials. That too.
You know, that's true. You know, people are always like, they ask you, where do I put my money? Where do I put my money? And I say, man, you should be worried about your access to your money. What happens if the power goes out? Where are you going to get your money? Do you know the answer to that? And most people, frankly, don't. You know, just worry about that stuff and stop worrying about, oh my God, what's going to happen in 20 years? The fear game is something that the media, and even a lot of big alt media, specializes in, is selling fear porn. They're really good at it. And it's debilitating. It'll freeze you like a deer in the headlights. And that's not where you want to be. You want to have a clear mind.
Agreed. And luckily we have people like you putting out incredible content to help draw the picture and give people some clarity in this world, particularly with the banking stuff. So, I appreciate your time today and all the work that you're doing. Hopefully this is the first of many. This was a great back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on. It's great to read, you know, it's always nice to be able to reach an audience that I don't really reach that much. I've only done one prior interview with anything crypto related. And that was a guy named a YouTube channel named Darren Moore Jr. Anyway, he's a good guy.
Yeah. Haven't met Darren yet.
But also a very knowledgeable guy too, like you.
Yeah, I bet there will be a bunch of Bitcoiners trying to send you paragraphs that explain Bitcoin and why it's a revolutionary technology.
That would be awesome. I look forward to that. That'd be great. You know, my email address, by the way, if you just go to my YouTube channel, whatever, I'll just tell you what it is. It's Titus, T-I-T-U-S, bestevidence@gmail.com. That's the email address of my channel. So if you've got the paragraph that can tell me on Bitcoin, send it. I'd love to see it.
Well, you've got your homework assignment, freaks. Let's get on it. John, thank you again. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot for having me. Hopefully I see you again.
All right. Keep crushing. Peace and love, freaks.